Welcome to RFN episode 311. I am your interim host, James Jones. You may be wondering where Johnny Metz is, but he's not here, so you can feel better about that.
Keep wondering.
With me today, Guillaume Veillette, our intrepid editor, and the only person who seems to make it to the show on time.
I am just psyched that the podcast is 50% Canadian again.
It is 50% Canadian again, because in Johnny's place, we have, is it fair to say, long-time listener?
Yeah, that's fair to say. 2 years counts, I guess.
Yeah, it's fine. And many, many time writer to the podcast. Donald, damn it. Damn it! All right, let's do that again.
Hours of practice.
I did. It's Theriot, right?
Theriot.
Okay, fine, sorry. Donald Theriot, who's also the host of the... Well, why don't you explain what it is, since you created it, or at least partially created it.
It started out as a 1 week replacement for when RFN was scattered to the winds. Now it's sort of a spin-off podcast.
Yep.
I have to say, I'm kind of scared about stepping into Johnny's 22.5e podcasting shoes. Oh, great. There's a DS in here.
That's a callback. So yeah, the podcast in question is Nintendo Free Radio. Yeah. There'll be a link to it in the show.
Now, what inspired the name?
I don't know where they got the terms from.
Yeah.
We're not exactly known for our originality.
That's fine. Neither are we, so we're good. And, of course, filling in again this week, not that that's a bad thing. I'm more than happy to have him here. Just to clarify, if my tone of voice sounded negative, it's not, because that means John's not here. Nate Andrews.
I'm sorry. I just kind of wandered in again.
It's fine, as long as you keep...
You guys are always so accommodating.
Just make sure the door locked behind you. We're good.
I won't mess up your bathroom.
But yes, as Guillaume pointed out, we're back to 50% Canadian, which might make this the only non-hockey podcast on the internet that can say that. So we have a good show this week. I'm not going to get over boisterous like Johnny. And we're actually going to start with like we always do, new business. And Donald, since you're the guest, you can go first.
Okay, well, main thing that I'm playing, in the interest of keeping this somewhat tax-deductible, is Pokemon Black 2. Managed to pick that up last week after having Lollipop Chainsaw for about 11 minutes in order to facilitate a trade for it.
Whoa. Explain that, because now I have just... What?
Okay. In my city, there's Best Buy, and then there's Future Shop, which is Best Buy bought it.
Okay.
Future Shop was running a deal. You could trade one game from a long list of qualifiers to get Pokemon for free. And that same weekend the Pokemon came out, Lollipop Chainsaw, which was one of the qualifying games, was on at Best Buy, literally across the street, for $20. So, yes.
What?
So, the day it came out, walked to Best Buy, picked up the game, unwrapped it so I could, you know, make it legal, and then walked over and picked up my Pokemon. I'd play the Japanese version, but now I actually get to see the localization. I think they did a pretty good job with it this time. It's not as good as when they had the Something Awful goon doing it, but certainly a lot better than some of the other English I've had to deal with in recent weeks.
That is easily the strangest trade that has happened since, I don't know, the invention of currency. So you normally don't play this in English, or is it just you've occasionally dallied into the Japanese version of the game?
I've dallied with the Japanese version because I was thinking about doing a strategy guide. I actually at one time was scheduled to do the player's guide for Ruby and Sapphire. Unfortunately, the company that was going to hire me quickly Chapter 7, which is, or whatever the word dead bankruptcy is, so that didn't work out. But I did.
Oh,
have
good.
To, yeah, so I did, but I it started a little tradition where I import one version and then I'll play through it, and then I'll get rid of it once the English one comes out and I've had a chance to strip my Japanese version.
I assume then that you played the original Black and White.
Oh, yeah.
Or a iteration of it.
I'm one of the few people on the planet who can say they've actually filled the white Pokedex. And the fact that I did that actually sort of plays into the storyline in Black 2. There's a method called the Unova Link, which basically it copies over information from Black 1 or White 1 that's plot relevant. And so in the game, there will be references to my player character from Black 1 doing things 2 years prior.
Oh, it's Mass Effect.
Yeah.
There you go. Nice.
But you're not playing the same character then.
No, it's a new character. He's from a completely different hometown, but they frequently refer to the old character, although one of the big disappointments for the fans was that they didn't actually have your old character show up.
Your old character is somewhat infamous then.
Yeah, he's mentioned. He's as one of the heroes who saved the continent 2 years prior from PETA, Team Plasma. Sorry. And later on, there's actually fights with your two rival characters from the first game, one of whom is now a gym leader and the other's a professor's assistant.
So I assume a large portion of our listening audience probably played the original Black and White. And Black 2, White 2 has not been out super long. So there's probably a certain amount that either have moved on from the DS, you know, they're on their 3DS, they weren't really in the market for DS games, or, you know, they just haven't gotten around to picking this game up yet. So can you speak briefly about, you know, A, what they've done to sort of enhance this game? I mean, obviously it's more than the standard third game sequel that they usually put out. I mean, it's a full new game.
Yeah.
But what have they done to really enhance the experience that is Pokemon Black 2 or Pokemon White 2?
Well, the main thing they've done this time is that they've brought back a lot of the old Pokemon, because Black and White, it was all new Pokemon until literally the post game. In Black 2, White 2, you can get old Pokemon starting from about the third route in the game, and they have a lot of the fan favorites come back pretty early on. So it's very easy to get a full team really quickly and run with that for a good portion of the game.
I'm kind of underwhelmed over here. Like,
yeah.
Just like, wouldn't long-time fans just have imported all their Pokemon anyway? You know.
Well, I mean, if you owned all the GBA games and then all the DS games, technically speaking, you could have all the Pokemon. But you would also have had to bought hundreds of dollars in games.
Yeah, I think sales figures show that lots of people have done that.
So with the game in question, or in Black 2 or White 2, is it the same mix as the previous Black and White in terms of what are available? Or is it, if you wanted to get everything, you might still have to get multiple copies of the same game? So if you had the first White, could you get Black 2 and be okay?
If you had, the only thing you'll really miss if you went from White 1 to Black 2 is that one of the post-game events is that you get the mascot legendary from the one that you didn't catch in White or Black, or depending on which game you play.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, but other than that, you can have, because they haven't changed around the rarity of, you know, which Pokemon are missing from each game all that much.
I gotcha. So how much of a new world are we talking about? I know it's the same continent, but how much has it changed? Are there enough callbacks that it's enjoyable, but enough new stuff that it feels new? Or, I mean, it's only been 2 years. The world shouldn't have changed that much.
Yeah. In the 2 years, there's some parts of the old world have actually been closed off. There's only about the mid portion of the game is going back to old areas, but the first couple of badges and the last couple of badges going into the elite to Victory Road and becoming champion is all new areas.
Okay.
They created a lot of new content. Even some of the areas that were previously only post-game areas are now in the game, and you can get to them pre-Elite Four, which actually helped me kind of break the game when I found a way to get to an area that had items you could sell for about 1.7 million Pokedollars.
For fans who, you know, they enjoyed Black or White, depending on which one they played, you know, maybe this game sort of fell off their radar because it came out so late. Would you say that it's like, what level of fandom should invest the time in Black 2 and White 2?
You know, any person who's played a Pokemon game before would enjoy it, because there's more different types of tournaments, and they actually have an achievement system in the game, so that it encourages you to do different things. Like, I'm actually playing through right now with an entire party of one element, the bug type, simply because I can. There's enough Pokemon that you can pull that off, so you have a chance to use a lot. And there's things like you can make movies in the game with some rather, shall I say, unique endings.
I mean, a qualifier to that.
Well, there's giant mecha fights, love stories, and you're doing this in the context of a Pokemon battle.
Wow.
Yeah.
They got a little weird on this one.
Yeah, I'm not trying to understand. Like, they've got Machinima in there? Like,
there's literally a what they call the Pokewood Studios, run by Mr. Stu Dio.
That's awful. That's terrible.
I don't know if I approve.
I will pause for the face palms here. But yeah, and basically you're given a Pokemon, and between the moves that your Pokemon uses and what you say in the game, that you make a movie out of that. Like there's one time you can do it very early on where you have to taunt one of the gym leaders from the last game into using a move that's not very effective on your Pokemon that you've rented, so that you can knock his out.
Oof. It does seem like this game was really made for, you know, the fans who really just like, yes, I want more Pokemon.
Yeah.
I guess they anticipated pretty much everybody who had the game to have played Black or White already.
Yeah. When I was playing the Japanese version, I didn't bring any of my old stuff in. It's a good Pokemon game if you haven't played in a while, especially mm-hmm. where you have all those old Pokemon. But if you have played it before, you do get the bonuses. Like you get to catch all of the Pokemon that one of your antagonists used in the first game, which was kind of scary when I nearly got wiped by a wild Pokemon that was 10 levels higher than me.
Hi, I'm gonna take the opportunity of being the host to take a very brief aside here and ask. So, do you think that are you ready for a 3DS Pokemon game? Let's put it that way.
I haven't had a chance to really fully explore this one yet, so I think, but I think we're probably going to see one about this time next year in Japan, whether we're ready or not for it.
Nintendo's ready for it. That's all that matters.
Nintendo likes printing money.
All right, so moving on, you also have another title for us. Why don't you go ahead and introduce that for us,
yes,
too?
Yes, the other title that links up to Black 2, actually, is Pokemon Dream Radar, the 3DS eShop download that actually came out the same day, although I didn't get it right away. Waited a couple of days just because I needed to get an eShop card. It's for a $3 download, it needs a lot more content for me to really be happy with it.
So can you briefly describe what it is?
Yeah, basically it's an AR game. Basically, this little app sends you, you meet this new professor who's working in the dream world to try and find all these Pokemon, and then it'll pop a visor up on the 3DS screen, and your job is to basically turn around and shoot down clouds. Some of them have orbs that power up, you can build up over time to power up your shots, and then some of the clouds have items or Pokemon. When you hit one of those, it'll change it into a sort of battle mode where a ball will swing around the screen. You have to keep shooting it with your 3DS until you wear it down. You have a time limit, so you can't just do it very lazily. And some of them will swing around from one side of your view to the other. I nearly twisted my neck 360 degrees trying to get one.
Oh, jeez. So it's Face Raiders, then.
I haven't played Face Raiders, but I'm assuming it's very similar to this, yes.
For $3! So it has connection to the twos, correct?
Yeah, you can use the, because you're catching Pokemon that have unique abilities in the game. Like, they do things that normal Pokemon can't do, or that the species can't do normally. And there's a couple of exclusive Pokemon. They were the trio from Black and White 1 in new forms, and you can transfer them up to Black 2. Or White 2, and they'll give an item that'll let you switch back and forth between the two forms of these legendary Pokemon.
Nintendo likes your money, Pokemon fans.
Yes.
Oh, you want that Pokemon's new form? Yeah, you're going to have to pay for it. They backdoor DLC'd these Pokemon. Yes, that is exactly what just happened.
Yes, and I am scared to think what that could mean for when the 3DS games actually come out.
It's a Pokemon level pack! 5 grass types, $5!
Jeez.
I'm thrilled that I now see clearly that we are. It's like, oh, you would want to get the one from the other color? How about $20 and you could just get a level pack with all of them?
Mm.
Oh, that feels inevitable now. I'm depressed. In fact, I'm so depressed. I want Nate to talk about something insane. Nate, what do you have that's insane to talk about?
I can bring it. I've been playing a game that's about as far from Pokemon as you can get. and that is Asura's Wrath. It's a Capcom game, which is kind of like God of War meets Hindu or Buddhist elements.
Right, but God of War, like the QTE elements, right?
Yeah, a little bit like that. So to give you some context, the game starts with what is basically a race of space gods fighting to rid the Earth of evil, impure monsters. And, you know, there's like a giant Buddha firing a massive, like, handheld orbital laser. And so it introduces you to, like, these legions of generals, of which Asura is one. And they each have, like, their own temperament and ability. Asura is just getting super pissed off. Like, everyone else...
Sweet power.
Yeah. Like, everyone else has some angle of a personality. Like, I'm the guy with the big fists, or I've got a sword. But Asura's like, I'm so mad! And then when he gets angry enough, he just grows a couple more arms. And so that battle concludes with them firing their super weapon, which is basically a gigantic bust of a man that fires a laser out of his forehead. And that's the intro.
Whoa, is this Choaniki?
I was going to say.
It's a little bit like that.
But
do they
like
call it the men beam? Or
they have some name for it. It's not that.
I just have to say that for someone who only knows Asura from the Final Fantasy summon, which heals you, you have officially blown my mind.
So I was going to say, like, my first experience with this game was last year's E3 when I got invited into Capcom's movie theater and they played all their games. Dragon's Dogma.
Right.
You know, they went through their list. And this is the game they ended with.
Yeah, I could see
like,
why.
Everybody in the room except me, I mean, it's this big theater. They darken it. They were doing about 15-minute rotations. Everybody in the room is just dumbfounded, except for me, who's super excited because a giant stone golem from space tried to poke Asura with his stone finger.
Yeah, so that happens. Like,
he's as big as a planet. He's just poking him.
Yeah, yeah. It's a third-person action game, so like in most cases, you're just doing a lot of simple attacks, a closer long range until you can do a burst attack, at which point you do like a quick time event to finish the fight. And that sounds boring on paper, but it's so crazy. Like, there's a great part in, like, the first boss fight where Asura's fighting one of his old, like, Legion brothers. And he has amnesia, so he doesn't recognize this guy anymore. And the guy is, like, launching into this diatribe of how great his grandeur and power is with, like, orchestral music in the background. And a button prompt comes up that just says, "Shut up, so-and-so," whatever the guy's name is. And if you press that button, Asura's like, "You talk too much." He sucker punches him in the stomach, and then you move on to the fight. If you happen to do well in the fight, there's a point where he just grabs him by the fucking face, slams him back and forth on the ground, and then throws him off a cliff. So...
I'm almost afraid of James having a button that says, "You talk too much."
So at least from what I've played, it works because of like how it manages spectacle. Which is a distinction I think needs to be made in some cases, because plenty of other games will just vomit spectacle left and right, you know. But in this game, everything is parceled out very nicely, from the amount of fighting you're doing at any one time, to how long you fight, to how quick time events are tossed in. Like, nothing about this game seems like it should work or be cohesive on any level.
No.
But it is, and I think that's why it's working for me.
So, I mean, I've seen it compared to like the presentation style of like an anime.
Yeah, yeah. It's actually broken up into chapters or episodes. So there's a distinct like to be continued and then previously on
the game you were just playing.
Yeah.
Asura got mad and ripped his arm off and threw it at people.
That's usually how it goes.
Nice.
Yeah, that was in the demo video or the demo they showed too, him ripping his arm off and throwing it at someone. I'm like, well, that's an awesome power.
Yeah.
Great.
It's amazing. Yeah, it's pretty cheap now. You can get it for like $20.
Is the combat itself actually good?
It's fine. Or? It's mostly a means to an end of you powering yourself up and doing the burst attacks, which leads you to like the quick time / you know, cinematic events.
I'm kind of reminded of the Dragon Ball fighting games, which are basically just you just punch each other for a while and then.
Well, actually, the team that made this is CyberConnect, and they made the Naruto games on the PlayStation 3.
Yeah.
The Shippuden ones, whatever. So yeah, I think that there's a lot of QTEs in those games as well. Like there's a lot of spectacle in between fights.
Yeah, yeah.
You'll have Naruto fighting some giant fox or whatever.
Uh-huh.
it does look like it's kind of in the same vein, except even crazier.
Yeah, like you're punching guys up close, every once in a while, but you're also, like, it'll throw in him running alongside, like, a capital ship, which is miles up in the sky, and just, like, targeting and shooting it as he runs and bringing the whole thing down.
Why not? You know, let's do this. I mean, if we're going to do this, might as well do it right.
No, it goes all the way.
The CyberConnect is an interesting connection because they did Soul to Robo as well, and they also used lots of presentational anime style, and not just in the graphics, but in the whole, like, previously on, next time on.
Uh-huh.
They even went so far as basically it was every 30 minutes, and there was, like, credits and opening music.
And then somebody gets angry and grows arms.
Well, that doesn't quite happen.
Well, but, like, the feature that Solato Robo needed the most, I think, was a shut up, you talk too much button.
Actually, it might have been a good addition. I'm not so good about him just punching people in the stomach for it, though. It sounds amazing.
It's a really cool thing.
Way.
I think a lot of people should check that out.
I think I need to get a hold of this.
Are you far enough along that you've had to consider getting the DLC, which apparently gives the true ending?
So, yeah, I've heard talk about that.
Fucking Capcom!
Yeah. I'm not quite that far along, so I don't know exactly what that entails, but I probably will.
But you're just encouraging them.
I need to see it.
YouTube.com.
I need to know everything!
Yeah, you can go that route if you want.
Tell me all your secrets, Asura. No, I don't talk. Oh, I got punched in the stomach. It sounds unbelievable. Like, it just feels like they just said, all right, let's just go crazy.
Yeah.
Oh, I love it. Thank you, Capcom. This is you at your best and at your worst at the same time, which is, that's basically Capcom for the last decade, really. So, moving on. Any other games to talk about?
Me? No.
Yep. Okay.
No, Asura is all I can handle. It fills me right up.
Well, he's got so many arms,
I know,
to be fair.
Yeah.
So I guess that leaves us with Guillaume.
Okay. Yes, I have been playing some video games this week, turns out. And I've been playing...
Which is good for the show.
I know. It's very convenient. So yeah, I've been playing co-op a couple of games with my girlfriend. Like, we hung out and I asked her, like, do you want me to come over or should you come over? And she said, well, your house has more video games. So,
nice.
That kind of settled it. We played some video games. Kirby Superstar on the Virtual Console, which we had started. So basically, we finished it. We were about halfway through the Great Cave Offensive, which is kind of topical because we played a game based on the Great Cave Offensive a couple of weeks ago. And I have to say that it's pretty surprising how the Amazing Mirror, as clunky as the map system was a vast improvement on Kirby Superstar.
That is a great relief.
Well, you know, the Great Cave Offensive does have the very confusing, door after door after door, and you're never sure where it's going to lead. And it also doesn't have maps, ever. You don't even find them. So yeah, good luck trying to pick the right door and then come back to it if you happen to have missed, some treasure. So yeah, that was a little bit clunky, and then after that, there's this one mode or this one mini game where you kind of you're timed the whole way through each level, so you're always racing against the clock.
Is that Revenge of the Meta Knight?
I think so. Well, yeah. So she did not enjoy that part too much. Being timed is a little bit stressful, and I don't know. I think it was okay, and I guess one of the advantages of, you know, being timed that way, of only having like 100 seconds to get through a stage, is that it's over very, very quickly. And then we finished the last world, Milky Way Wishes, I believe. Overall, we were kind of disappointed in the game. I think that Kirby Superstar was my first Kirby game ever, and I had played it co-op the first time with a friend. So when I got it on VC and I played through it by myself, I thought, oh, you know, this is not as fun as I remembered, but maybe it's just because I'm not playing co-op. So now that I've played co-op again, I'm just realizing that perhaps I have such fond memories for this game just because it was the very first time that I played a Kirby game. And since then, I think that certainly Return to Dreamland has trounced it. And I haven't played Epic Yarn myself, but my girlfriend has, and she prefers that one vastly. So I don't know. I guess it was fun, but I mean, it was kind of eye-opening how the game doesn't really stand up, in my opinion.
I've actually been playing that recently myself with the collection that just came out. Was there one power that you really gravitated toward when you were playing through, especially with Milky Way Wishes, where you can grab them permanently?
I like the one where you kind of have to build up static electricity and shoot that at people. That was pretty cool.
The plasma,
yeah. But I can't remember what she used. I think she just, you know, stuck with whatever. She was playing as the second player. So, you know, she was tagging along and she was playing the non-Kirby character. And I think she just basically kept whatever I happened to give her, you know, when she died. And then I revived her by giving her my power. So, yeah, I don't know. The game just doesn't seem to hold up all that well, in my opinion.
But in terms of it being a multiplayer game, though.
Yeah, it's not ideal. Like,
no,
that would be one of the reasons why Return to Dreamland is so superior. I mean, there is definitely one prime Kirby, but at least you can have more than one Kirby. I mean, you will have the first player who does have more abilities than the rest. And in some situations, he'll be the only one who can clear out the way or use one of those mega powers. But, you know, at least the other people are still able to be Kirby and to copy powers. And if they want to play King DDD or something like that, they can. But, yeah, like, there's more choice, and they're not as much of a kind of a second fiddle as the second character in Kirby Superstar is, because in that situation the camera doesn't even try to follow you. Like, if you're off screen, then you turn into a star and you're slingshot right back to next to Kirby. Whereas in something like Return to Dreamland, I think that the screen stretches a little bit, you know, like it zooms out a little bit to keep track of everyone. And I think that if someone can't keep up, he does, like, the people can't really go too far ahead without him. Although it's been a while now.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I might be lying right now.
Good.
Yeah, just go with it.
They do warp back, and it feels like, because I know Sonic 2 was the big multiplayer platformer I'd played before that, and it did the same thing with Tails, where you just helicopter back to you.
Right, yeah. So, you have the collection. First, how did you get it? Because the game isn't really being sold in Quebec. Is it being sold in the rest of Canada?
What is with the economy up there?
It's not the economy. It's our language laws that are protecting me from buying Kirby.
Nice.
I think that Nintendo is a little bit too lazy to actually, you know, localize Kirby games. And there is, you know, like, I don't think that it's the law, but there, like, it's strongly encouraged that stores sell French versions of games. So, yeah, I think that's what the situation is.
There isn't one, and they just don't stock it?
Yeah.
I think that's the route that Nintendo has chosen to take this time. And it's not the first time. Metroid Prime Trilogy wasn't being sold here.
Which is weird, because I would presume there are French versions of all of those games.
Indeed. Yeah, it's a really crummy situation, because you can bet your ass that in France, they're all translated, you know. And most of the time, the translations that Nintendo of Canada uses is the same translation. You know, like, they're not localizing it expressly just for Quebec, except in really rare cases. Like, I think Super Mario Galaxy actually had a poutine reference.
Wow.
just like this show. And I was hoping we could avoid it this week, and
with 50% Canadians, I don't think so.
Ruined it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Johnny's not here, so.
I was going to say, because I know someone on NeoGaf, hi Gaff, basically, he was trying to purchase Halo 4 from the retailer I went to, and he couldn't get it because he was in Quebec, and they literally refused to sell him the English version, ordering off the website. No, your shipping address is Quebec. You get the French version. Oh, wait, there's no French version. You get nothing. You lose. Good day, sir.
Okay, that is weird.
Yeah.
All right, maybe I'll do some investigating. I don't know. All right, so, oh, yeah, but the question I wanted to ask you, Donald, is that have you tried the challenge rooms in the collection?
I did, and actually I mentioned this on the show that's coming out shortly here, but I did try the first set of the challenge rooms, and it's I really want to play Return to Dreamland now because I had a lot of fun with them.
Yeah, and you know, don't forget there is a hidden platinum medal for each of those rooms that the game doesn't tell you about. So even once you achieve the requirements for the gold medal, you're not done. So good luck.
Bastards.
Yeah, so after Kirby, we turned towards the PlayStation 3, and I played a game that I have had for a long time, again, for free through PSN Plus. I'm sorry, Sony is not paying me to say this. I think they should, though.
They can't afford it!
And so I've been playing Lara Croft and the Guardian of Light. So it's kind of old news for a lot of people. I think that game is 2 years old now. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it turned out to be a lot of fun, especially in co-op, because I did afterwards try it by myself, and it's really not the same thing. One issue I have with the game, well, first of all, if you know, when you hear Lara Croft, you think of a traditional Tomb Raider game, you know, third-person action, platforming, stuff like that. This one is a set camera, isometric view, and it's more of a twin-stick shooter, in a way, but one with more platforming in it and a little bit more puzzle-solving. And I guess the interesting thing about it is that you have two characters to take control of. You have Lara, of course, and you've got some sort of Aztec warrior who's there to try to help you, you know, bring down some god that some competitor of yours has awoken. So you travel together all the time, and while Lara has, you know, a set of guns, and she's light, and so she can stand on some things that the big beefy warrior can't, he's carrying spears, an endless supply of spears, which is really handy. And these spears he can throw in walls, and so Lara can just basically stand on the spears and access new ground that way. So a lot of puzzles have to do with that, you know, getting cooperating together to try to cross certain types of terrains. And Lara herself has this kind of a grappling cord or whatever, like she can shoot a grappling hook. And so that's how the other guy can tag along. So solving puzzles, you know, cooperatively is something pretty new, I think, in this type of game, and it's definitely the best part of it. We had a ton of fun trying to figure out, okay, how do we reach this power up or things like that. What is a little bit less interesting, I think, is the combat. I've already played a twin stick shooter this year, and that's basically enough for me. So a second one in a short time is a lot to ask of me, to be honest. And the thing is, like, the combat is not really more interesting than in any other twin-stick shooter that you've played. And the combat always interrupts you as you're trying to solve puzzles. There are some rooms where you won't be bothered too much, but if you're out there in the outside of a level, then, you know, you can't expect demons to just appear out of thin air and, you know, just screw with you, and you have to get rid of them before you can get back to whatever it is that you were doing. So I found that a little annoying. And another thing I found kind of annoying is that the game just won't quit it with the tutorials during the first two stages. It was so annoying. Like, right away, you start the game, you watch the opening cutscene, and you haven't even gotten out of the first room that you get this tutorial message that pops up, and it tells you how to use your bombs to open doors. So, okay, that's cool. I'm going to use bombs to open doors. So you get out of that room, and then it tells you, okay, like, turns out this is a twin-stick shooter. You move with this stick, you aim with this stick, and you start firing by pressing the R2 trigger. And like, okay, fine. And then, like, basically every room that you enter afterwards, there's always some new interruption, some new tutorial. And, you know, like, I was getting really, really annoyed. And that goes up to even the second level, where you still have tutorials that show you about the map that you can bring up. And I was really getting fed up. And the thing is, like, the as I said, the combat is not really that interesting. So they could have, you know, like, I understand that when you've got a game that tries to do something a little bit more complex, like this game does, I mean, it's not just a twin stick shooter. There's puzzles to solve. So I understand perhaps the need for tutorials, but they could have streamlined some things. I mean, the combat didn't need to have different types of weapons. Like, they don't really bring anything. I don't know. Like, I think that the game would have been better if it had played to its strengths a little bit more and not bothered too much with the things that perhaps we expect from this type of game.
You prefer Lara Croft to be helpless and not the person who's controlling her, like in the Tomb Raider 2013.
Oh, you jerk! That is not what I'm saying. I'm just saying there could have been fewer enemies, and there could have been less combat, and that would have made for a better game. I think that the game was fine with, you know, just being mostly puzzles.
I can see that, you know, I've never felt the combat in the Tomb Raider games was great.
Right.
I always felt like it was like, okay, I can get through this, but I'd really rather not. So, you know, maybe that's, I can see why I'd just be like, all right, just give me more puzzles then. Because really, to me, those were always, I want to say puzzle games, but you know what I mean. I mean, like...
Right. Well, exploration and discovering things and figuring things out. Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I would have liked more out of this game. And it does have that. Like, it does offer that. It's just that the interruptions were getting a little bit too much during the first two levels. And short of giving you fewer tutorials, just give us fewer extraneous things to do. You know, like, they could have made the game better by basically just sticking with what worked.
Yeah, I could see that.
In the earlier Tomb Raider games, they had the tutorial stuff as a separate mode you could go into before you actually started playing the game. Should they maybe have done that with Guardian of Light?
Well, maybe. I mean, the thing is, I understand the need for the tutorial, but it's especially annoying, I think, when you're playing co-op, because I don't know about you guys, but when I'm playing co-op with someone, I kind of want something that's easy to get in, like pick up and play.
Yeah.
And so the more complex it is, the harder that is to achieve. And so, you know, like, perhaps in the long run, this is better. Like, perhaps if we end up picking up where we left off and going through the entire game, maybe I'm going to change my tune. But historically, these co-op games, I usually just play, you know, once. We get through, like, the beginning, just as long as it's fun, and at some point we get bored and we turn it off, and we normally don't get back to it. And that's not just with my girlfriend. I mean, like, when I have friends coming over, we usually just start Contra, you know, or, yeah, Super Contra, usually, and go through that game. It's not even an hour long, and it's just enough, you know? And there's no need to explain anything. You just know what you're supposed to do. Just go to the right, shoot everything that moves. There you go. That's basically what I've been playing this week.
Okay. Cool. So, I have a game to talk about, kind of. So, in...
Kind of?
Kind of. It's kind of a game. For whatever reason, I have never actually played Minecraft beyond the Xbox demo when it came out, because it just seemed like it was a tremendous waste of time.
Sure.
Not the first person I've heard say that.
If you look at it from the outside, it does feel like you are doing things that are more tedious than your job. I mean, you basically sit there and do the same thing for a long time. However, thanks to a glitch, apparently, the Xbox version became the one to get because you didn't have to mine all your materials. However, they fixed that glitch, which meant it was the perfect time for me to jump in and buy the game. So, I went and purchased the Xbox version of this game.
So, can I ask why you purchased the Xbox version?
I have a good answer for that, actually.
Okay.
So, I would have never played it on the PC. There's two reasons. One, just sitting at my desk chair and playing it on the PC for hours at a time just felt really not comfortable.
Sure.
I'm not like physically uncomfortable, but just I wouldn't want to sit there at my PC for hours at a time looking for sheep so I can shear them. However, on my TV is about 35 inches. My recliner is amazingly comfortable, and the Xbox controller just sort of sits in your hands lovely like a cloud.
Uh-huh.
It's a very laid-back approach to playing the game. I actually ended up buying it in part because Microsoft keeps splashing it on the splash screen of the Xbox experience,
yeah,
whatever they're calling the current splash screens. It's basically up there,
they
I'd
call
say.
Those ads.
Yeah. Well, they don't call them ads, but that's effectively what they are. In fact, sometimes they do call them ads, but that's for other people's stuff because Microsoft's system for serving you ads has ads on it.
Uh-huh.
Genius.
So Minecraft.
So just how big of a penis have you been able to build in your world?
I haven't. So I've been too busy.
It's unfinished is the problem.
Yes, it's an unfinished penis, yes. So the first thing I did – I mean, I've seen videos of the game. I conceptually understand how it is. I get that basically the first day is a race to build a shed so you're not killed by monsters in the middle of the night. I opted for a different solution, which is just dig into the ground and stay safe like a I don't know, like a mole.
Uh-huh.
And my thought was, well, I'll just dig a small hole here, put a door in front of it, and this will be my camp until I have all my resources together. But instead, what it's turned into is I have dug out in about, say 4 hours of the game, I have dug out the mines of Moria.
Oh.
And I've basically been digging constantly to the end of the – I mean, I've dug straight through, and it completely emptied out the hill, the first hill I came across. So it's basically just a shell at this point. And then I have started digging under the ground to the next hill. It's just bizarro land in there at this point. And I realized I haven't built a damn thing. That's what it came down to. All I've done is reinforce the walls of my giant cave with stone.
So you're just sitting there in your chair doing, like, cathartic digging?
Pretty much. Okay. It's dig, 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 and then occasionally I'll So I started with just the wall and dug in. So there were no monsters in the chamber. It was very regularly cut. I was hewing it out of stone in a very orderly fashion. It was like reverse Tetris.
Mm-hmm.
And as I kept going deeper and deeper and deeper, and the area expanded, I quickly came to the realization of I'm never going to build a house. I'm going to live underground. And I carved the whole face of the hill off and just put stone on the front. Just so I could find it when I'm walking around. Because it's not a house. You can't see it. All I have is a door. So, like, I would just get lost and then spend, like, a day out in the wilderness hiding. Because I couldn't find my house.
This is fascinating.
It was a hill amongst a collection of hills.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, this is how the hobbits live. This is terrible. So I have completely emptied out the ground under one hill. Basically gone down about, I'd say about 12 or 13 blocks deep below sea level. So, like, I'm got to be pushing up against the end of what the depth is.
Uh-huh.
Like, it's I've busted through into a cavern one time, found it was completely full of monsters, and just stone blocked the shit out of that cavern. Like, and just marked it, do not go in here again. It is bad. This is bad place. And then just proceeded to keep mining. And uh-huh. At some point, I realized I had passed out from under my hill when I broke ground and I got flooded because I broke into a riverbed.
Right.
I'm like, well.
So were you able to just load up your save file?
Yeah. Oh, I didn't die. All of a sudden, water just came rushing in. I'm like, well, this sucks. So I just patched the hole and said, okay, I can't dig that way anymore. Let's go under it. Just kept digging down and down and down.
Do you see yourself ever being constructive in any way? Or are you just like working through some sort of complex, like just going down as far as you can?
So what I figured I would do, so I've built this lovely spiral staircase to take me back from the bottom of my pit that I have to keep expanding because I'm actually carving it into negative space. I'm carving around the shape of it. So basically the spiral staircase is being hewn out of solid rock like I'm some, like, I'd say, 5th century Middle Eastern Christian community. I have to dig my church out of the ground. But instead of just keep digging, digging, digging. And eventually the thought was, I'll bust through the top and build something amazing on top of the hill. Like, this is the beacon where I've come from. But, I have just been basically doing nothing. And it's kind of a relaxing game, and you can lose track of time literally doing nothing. And the downside here is, if I had iron, like, I have some, but not much. If I had coal, again, I have some, but not much. I feel like I would be much more productive. Like, you have to have these to make the better items, and then the better items let you get even better items. It seems that it takes a really long time to get started. And for me, just going down deeper and deeper was an attempt originally to find materials to get started. I'd always intended that this was just going to be base camp until I had enough iron and coal that I could leave and not need to come back for a while, and I could build a proper monument to my ego. But instead, it just became the pit.
It just sounds so weird to me because, you need to find more material, but for what? So you can find more material. It just sounds like you're rolling rock up a hill, and that's what you're going to keep doing over and over again.
It is a little Sisyphean, but, I mean, the beauty of it, I think, is in the ability to create things with the better material you find. It's like, I could build, like a giant train system to take people around my awesome pit, but it's a freaking pit. Where are you going to go? But, I want to do this stuff. I want to build, switches that control, an automatic bridge maker, which in the demo on the 360 version, when you download the demo, it takes you to a pre-built world. And one of the things in it is there's this switch you hit, and it fires up a machine that builds its own bridge across a ravine. It's actually really cool. I've seen demos of people building APUs just in the game that can do real math. It's like, wow, that's actually really awesome and super inefficient. But still, that's pretty amazing. But me, I'm just digging. I mean, at some point, I have to do something with this. Eventually, I'm going to cross into, I assume there's some ground level that if you bust through, everything goes to hell. Maybe literally. At some point, I'm going to hit this. I need to do something else. So that's why I keep trying to branch out, but I just end up...
I gave you the answer early in the podcast.
Which is?
Giant penis.
Yeah.
Maybe so. Maybe that is my life's calling.
A giant monument to yourself.
Penis.
It's the giant figure of you.
Maybe that's what I'll build on top of the hill. It's a penis. It's also a light tower. You can climb up it. You can look over my domain, for this is the giant stone penis.
Tasteful and useful.
We have now alienated anybody on this show who has any sense of decorum. Go us. And that's how we're going to wrap up new business. So,
all right.
Stick with us. I think we need a break after that anyway.
No, we do need it. Yes.
Yes.
Yes, we do. So stick with us, and we'll be right back with a two-parted feature discussion right after this.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
This week we have a review of Skylanders Giants by Neil Ronahan. Neil still hearts Skylanders, and there's new stuff in the sequel that makes him heart it all the more. And for proof, here's a feature, Skylanders Giants Character Guide by Neil Ronahan! Did I mention that Neil hearts Skylanders? Here's a guide for all the characters from the original Skylanders and the just-released sequel.
In non-Skylanders news, we have Impressions of Kogura by Danny Eshoff-Vivens. Did you know director Vic Avruca is making a 3DS game? He is, and it's about tanks! Danny's had some hands-on time with the sadistic serving of shooting and suffering, and despite the shellacking, he likes it.
It's alliteration.
And speaking of things that are liked, Zach Miller really liked Code of Princess for the 3DS. You can check out his review on the site. Atlas has produced a brilliant brawler, and Zach is enamored. The less said about the main character's attire, or lack thereof, the better. Hurry and go get it, because it's Atlas. They've already sold out.
It's true.
We have a preview of Paper Mario Sticker Star by Scott Thompson. It's almost here, finally. In a matter of weeks, Sticker Star could be yours. Until now, enjoy more of our coverage of the latest Flat Mario. We also have an interview with Dan Vargas, the art director of Marvel Avengers Battle for Earth by Neil Ronahan and Jared Rosenberg. Live from Comic-Con, find out about Wii U's super-powered superhero super game in this super video interview.
We have impressions, Monster Hunter 3 Ultimate by Ariel Ruff. So it turns out we are getting Monster Hunter 3DS, and Capcom brought the game to Comic-Con to show it off. It sounds like this 3DS version is the way to play, and if it isn't, just transfer the save to the Wii U, the game, and system, not included. We have a review, Robot Rescue 2 by Guillaume Veillette.
Who's and, that?
I'm reading that myself because James doesn't think that far ahead when he writes this stuff.
I do not.
Robot Rescue 2 is a DSiWare game that I reviewed. Do robots have...
Jesus Christ.
I really should read ahead.
I was curious if you'd I originally wrote it for myself.
Okay, so James writes, "Do robots have balls? Because this puzzle game is as hard as them. Good thing it's good then." Yes, it's good. Check it out. As well as all of the other great content you'll find on NintendoWorldReport.com.
Welcome back. So Nate had to step out, so it's just the three of us now. Not that's a problem. You should be excited. Three of us have much to discuss. So right now we're a little light on listener mail, which of course we always want you to send to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. But so instead I went ahead and picked two topics that we can discuss somewhat, you know, at length, and then hopefully that will suffice for this week. So it's like I wrote my own listener mail. So instead what we're going to talk about are some topics that I've prepped the guys on a little bit, but I'll give some intro here for the listeners. I happened across an article when I was reading Forbes, because I'm a money gentleman of leisure, written by Eric Kane, spelled with K's both times, titled, "How Nintendo is Taking Over the Japanese Video Game Market, One IP at a Time." And his article basically summarized as this, that Nintendo has recently over the last year plus, begun amassing these IPs that are very Japan-centric. And it seems like they're making a strong effort to sort of solidify their own offerings by gaining their own access to these other properties that have some resonance in Japan. The examples he cites have varying levels of cultural relevance, and some of them aren't necessarily exclusive, but they just have been recently. So some of his argument is kind of flexible. Nintendo's publishing of the Bayonetta sequel on Wii U, their acquisition of the Fatal Frame franchise, the fact that Monster Hunter has been effectively Nintendo exclusive since Monster Hunter 3 came out. It's not technically true, but it for the foreseeable future, every Monster Hunter game is coming out on a Nintendo platform. A similar situation going on with Dragon Quest. He also mentions the acquisition of Monolith, even though that was years and years ago. And he also speaks briefly about Western franchises, Zombie U and Rayman from Ubisoft. His point was that with Nintendo starting to acquire these Japan-centric properties and other, you know, powerful brands, are they trying to consolidate power in a market they already hold considerable sway over? Sony has recently had very widely publicized financial troubles, and right now the Vita is not exactly being a strong seller for them. So what I wanted to talk about with us is, A, do you feel like Nintendo's really adopted a new strategy here, or is this an extension of things they've done in the past? Or do you think maybe this was just opportunities that popped up? And B, what effect do you think this kind of stuff is going to have on that market and vicariously on the other markets that in which they serve their software?
Well, Nintendo's gone out and gotten exclusives before. They had the Dream Team with the N64 that you guys talked about a few months back. And, well, you probably speak to this better than I can because I'm sort of on the periphery of gaming at that point, but the Capcom 5.
Yes. Of which one of them ended up being exclusive?
And one of which never even came out, so.
Yeah.
But Nintendo's had a history, and there's been times when they've been the de facto platform in Japan, like with basically the Famicom and Super Famicom. So they would get some of their... So I don't think this is a new strategy for Nintendo. I think it's just they see Sony in a moment of weakness, and they're trying to take advantage of it.
So do you think it's they see Sony in a moment of weakness, or do you think it's other publishers see Sony in a moment of weakness and they're willing to strike a deal? I mean, Bayonetta and Fatal Frame are both kind of weird one-offs. I mean, Nintendo's been working with Namco for a little while now, and they basically... Honestly, I'm not even going to speculate. I have no idea why the hell Nintendo bought the Fatal Frame franchise. Anybody want to provide some insight? Because I've got nothing.
Maybe it was cheap.
I would hope so.
That's actually my guess for like most of the questions that we have here.
Because maybe they were all just really cheap.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's no secret that the console market has been shrinking for a while in Japan. Most people just game on their handhelds, and so they just and Nintendo has got that locked down. You know, the handheld market, their biggest competition on there is the PSP. So, they're in pretty good shape there. And, like franchises like Bayonetta or Fatal Frame, they don't sell all that great. So, yeah, I can't figure how just, you know, how much Nintendo would have paid for them. Basically, all they have to do is finance a, you know, not exactly AAA budget, and they got a game on their hands, and they don't have to work on it. They've got experienced teams making their franchises for them. So it's just, I think it was just like a good deal.
I kind of felt that way about Fatal Frame. Like, I felt like maybe Namco was having a yard sale. I mean, that's really all I could come up with. And I don't mean, maybe literally.
That's actually, Fatal Frame would be Tecmo Koei.
Tecmo. I think Tecmo is having a yard sale, which is entirely possible with them. Nintendo's connection with that franchise is recently has been somewhat odd. They published the Wii game in Japan.
Yeah.
And then they produced that DS game, that weird DS spin-off-y thing.
Yeah, the horror game that you have to play in full daylight.
Yeah, with a book.
And they didn't even put the Fatal Frame name on that one. I don't know if that...
No, they didn't. Spirit Camera.
Yeah. Did that come out after the deal closed to buy the Fatal Frame IP? It probably did, but...
It did. But still, I mean, it's a Fatal Frame game. I mean, you still have to have the license to put... You can't just make, yep, this game's not Fatal Frame, guys. Psh, don't tell anybody. I mean, the same teams worked on it. I mean, this isn't... Nobody involved didn't know what was going down at that point. It's... I don't know. The whole Fatal Frame one seems weird. Bayonetta, yeah. If you read it, it sounds like Sega didn't want to make pay for a sequel. Obviously, Sega probably couldn't afford to pay for a sequel right now. They're not in great financial situation. I think, you know, to an extent, this might just be Nintendo. This is a franchise that that came up as an opportunity that they could say, you know, on Wii U there are action games and we're not making all of them. Look at this. Because they knew whatever they're going to get was going to be flashy. It was going to show well, and there was a section of the gaming public, both in Western markets and in Japan, that really liked the Bayonetta liked Bayonetta, and this right. would be their way of saying, look, we have games like this too, because the Wii didn't. Maybe also they wanted to get the chance to work with Platinum
and to get set up for Wonderful 101.
Yeah, well, I mean that's priority. I mean, yeah, it's true. They already have Wonderful 101 with a working Maybe they're trying to ingratiate themselves further with Platinum, in which case, just pay the money and get them. Monolith, like I said, you know, that was way in the past, and they abused them when they first bought them to produce Disaster Day of Crisis. So even though they produced what is probably the best RPG of this generation, they are effectively out of the conversation. But Dragon Quest is more interesting. And Monster Hunter. They're both really, really Japan-centric franchises. They are huge in those markets. And, you know, we can sort of explain Dragon Quest. You know, they saw the writing on the wall regarding handheld play and said, well, we want to put this on the most popular handheld. So they published a ton of DS Dragon Quest games.
Yeah.
We've talked about that. But I still don't understand Dragon Quest X.
Yeah, and the whole situation is just absurd when you think that the game has to ship with its own USB key, USB memory. Because yes. the Wii just doesn't have any.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was absolutely ill-suited to host an MMO, and yet that's what they made it for.
This is the one instance, I mean, personally, where I feel like it had to be a Nintendo wheeling and dealing situation, because there is literally no reason this game should be on Wii.
Historically, the makers of Dragon Quest have always said, we're going to put these games on the console that sells the most.
That's true.
Yeah.
But then the DS would be, you know, like that explains the DS, but not exactly the Wii. I mean, it did sell really well in Japan, and it has outsold the other consoles, but you could still make, I don't know, like another DS game.
You could make the argument they could put this on the PS3 in Japan and be very successful.
Maybe they didn't want to cannibalize the potential sales of a Final Fantasy 14, because I don't think you want to have, it didn't seem like you'd want to have more than one. But then again, Final Fantasy 14 has its own problems, so...
It's self-cannibalizing. well, to be fair, when they announced this game, Final Fantasy 13 was still being developed. So, I mean, shoot, who knows? Yeah, I don't quite know what goes on at that company, but they're very successful. One company he didn't mention is Level 5, which seems to leverage themselves quite nicely across various platforms, although it does seem like they're doing quite well on getting stuff on 3DS from them. I would say right now they're a more interesting play than anybody, but... Obviously, they've reached a point now where they're not susceptible to your money hats because they've got plenty of their own. Thank you very much.
Yeah, they have. And they're going pretty heavy on the PSP this year.
Yeah, they
in
are.
In Japan. And then I think the opening is going to be next year when they have to move to 3DS.
I mean, they've got a fair number of 3DS games coming out as well. I mean, yeah. and your repertoire of Inazuma games coming out for everything.
Yeah, and they're doing the Capcom thing of porting everything to everything. If the release list from Japan, I've seen, are any indication.
Yeah, they're to me, they're the most interesting play. But I do wonder, do you think any of these alone, I mean, Monster Hunter and Dragon Quest aside, because those aren't Nintendo exclusives. They have been effectively Nintendo exclusive to an extent, but they are not officially Nintendo exclusives. Do you think the ones that are have had any real meaningful impact on the marketplace? Or do you think that market is pretty much being driven by its own forces? Like, if this were a concerted effort by Nintendo to lock down the Japanese market, do you think they've actually accomplished anything?
I think they probably would have gone for bigger franchises, no? Like Resident Evil, which still sold extremely well in Japan.
Kazari 6 did 700,000 combined across PS3 and 360 in Japan. Most of that PS3, obviously. But I think this is Nintendo showing that they have a giant war chest. It's, you know, $5-6 billion at last report. And obviously they're not afraid to swing that stick around. I think this is a start. I think this is a sign that they're going to get, that they want Japan on lockdown. But I think this is a start, but I'm hoping they're going to go for things like a Persona 5 and maybe a new, something similar to a Revelations for Resident Evil from Capcom.
I don't really view this necessarily as a hard play. I think the author oversold it a little bit. I think it's more Nintendo. I think it's closer to what you just said. Nintendo has money, and they're willing to spend it. And right now in the Japanese market, that makes them sort of exclusive in that position. I mean, the only people really willing to spend money besides them or in position to do it is Level 5, who is spending money. But they're spending money actually outside of Japan on development houses outside, so...
It seems to be, to me, that they're going the opposite way of everyone else. Every other Japanese publisher is looking for smaller Western studios to take care of their popular franchises.
Yeah.
And Nintendo instead is like, screw that. We're not farming out anything. Instead, we're just going to pick
just
up
buy
all
your
these...
franchise.
Yeah, we're going to hunt down the small studios that, you know, disgruntled longtime veterans of the industry have started and that are failing, and we're just going to pick up the good stuff that other publishers have left on the ground.
That's a little kind of interesting parallel to their Sakurai stuff, where they're like, hey, he left because he got kind of burned out working here and he wanted to do his own thing. So let's go ahead and enslave him for the next 10 years. Oh, you thought you were free. No. Oh, I can't say. And then I mentioned the Ubisoft games, but Ubisoft's they'll put out for anybody.
That's and their MO is to flood at launch. And
Nintendo right now is a company that is guiding a system, is sunsetting a very, very successful system and trying to bankroll at least a portion of that success onto a new platform.
Yeah, and they've had like Little Mac and Fight Night games before, so it's not like they're not used to handing out their properties.
They had Mario and NBA Jam.
Yeah.
SSX on tour.
Oh, that, by the way, that was NBA Jam, was NBA Street. I can't remember, but it
NBA
was
NBA Street Volume 3.
Yeah. Yeah. It was amazing in this weird, like, am I high kind of way. Anyway. I think we can kind of set that aside and transition, because it's a nice transition point to this second topic, which is, you know, we're about a month away from the release of the Wii U. Was it November 18th?
Yeah, 1 month from the night we're taping this, actually.
Yeah, 1 month from right now. And Nintendo is kind of, I mean, I haven't seen any marketing blitz going on. We've had reports that they're putting in demo kiosks in Best Buys, and then they're following up by putting demo kiosks in GameStops. But I haven't really seen much marketing here. I understand that at least in the UK they've started some marketing. Nintendo's got kind of a weird challenge on their hands. So on the Wii, their marketing challenge was basically the show the family in the room waggling around looking ridiculous. And, you know, that's what the game is, you know. This is what we do. With the DS, they just sort of had celebrities playing games, and that was just sort of their selling point. But the Wii U, beyond being two screens, and the 3DS, you know, we've sort of seen this. I mean, it's hard to demo 3D on a screen, on a TV screen, so it doesn't seem like they've even tried. But on the Wii U, besides the tablet and having the challenge of showing two screens, which ultimately seems manageable, the Wii U is sort of a many things for many people. I mean, it does lots of different stuff. It's a very non-Nintendo console. How does Nintendo market the Wii U? Like, what's their plan?
Well, the thing is, the fact that it can be many things to many people is perhaps working against them, because when I talk to people who don't really follow video games as closely as I do, which is everyone, I just get... a lot of people around me are like, you know what, I don't get the Wii U, so what, like, you can play your game on the TV or the controller? And I'm like, well, yeah, in some cases, you can switch from the TV to the screen on your controller. And, oh, but also you can have a map there, like, you can use both. And they're like, really? And, you know, like, the fact that it varies from game to game, and it can make explaining what the Wii U is about almost impossible. You know, you can't just fit it in one clean sentence. Like, the Wii U is this. I mean, the Wii was motion controls. Right. The Wii is, you want to play bowling, you throw that ball, you know?
Yeah.
And the Wii U is, well, you want to do asymmetrical multiplayer? Then grab the gamepad controller, and I'll use the old remotes, and, you know, we'll make it work somehow.
It seems like just, if we were to just cue the conversation to the gameplay style, it is a much weirder sell. I mean, graphically now they should be able to sell their games just on... I mean, they should be able to do the standard visual presentation that they've somewhat eschewed during the Wii's life cycle, because obviously it wasn't as powerful as its competitors.
Mm-hmm.
But they need to sell a new console, not just games. So somehow they have to work out showing how this tablet makes games better. And, I mean, Zombie is kind of a game that you could show it on a bit, but even that's somewhat difficult, and they really can't make, you know, a comprehensive ad campaign around that game. It's just a little too violent, a little too bloody.
Right.
Rayman is an interesting game, for me at least, but I'm not sure how you would show that, and since it's missed launch, now what does that leave you with? New Super Mario Bros. U?
Well, the thing is, I'm not sure if they need, like, are we talking TV commercials here? Because
Well, I mean, that's one form of marketing, obviously. But if we're talking about, like, PR marketing, where they take it on shows, like that on the Wii was on every talk show on Earth.
Right.
I mean, like, how, and just people seeing it, you know, at stores, or people seeing it in their friends' homes. How do you position this thing for word of mouth and for effective selling of the gameplay stratagem, what they've built as a gameplay conceit?
I think the fact that they're literally the first new console to hit the market since the Wii will help with that, because there's a certain percentage of the population that's going to buy the new system day one regardless. And a lot of what helped the Wii succeed early on was people coming over, oh, hey, you got the Wii, and then all of a sudden, hey, Wii Sports. Now, whether Nintendo Land is the game that can do what Wii Sports did, still to be announced, and it's not as simple to explain that as it would be to explain bowling and baseball and golf, but they're, between Nintendo fans and technophiles, they've got a good start, and they've got things like TV, which they've confirmed will be there at launch. And heaven knows that there's like smart TVs and all the and boxy boxes and Rokus and all that are flying off the shelves. So they've got some advantage there. I could actually see cable companies getting in on the Wii U at some point, saying, here's an extension to your TV. You can control the DVR with this tablet. It also plays games.
If we're talking about just straight up advertisements, do you devote time to saying, look, this is a multimedia box that you can control the TV with? Would they actually put advertisements out there that touted those features? You know, there's a sort of anti-Nintendoism going on with this, because for generations, this is a games console. It plays games. It uses a proprietary disc format that makes it so we couldn't do anything else if we wanted to.
Maybe I just have a little bit more faith in Mario, 2D Mario platforms. I think I wrote in about that before. But I could easily see a Mario showing off New Super Mario U and then moving and then switching over to the TV portion of it. So you get the this plays games, but it also does this.
To me, it feels like they've talked about TV a lot, and it feels to me like they view this as a major selling point. And
right.
You know, it could well be. I want to see the interface myself to know how good it really is. But you know, I also want to know if they view this as a major selling point, how are they going to sell it? To me, it feels like we're probably in for some commercials that go really fast-paced through feature sets, and I think that's a terrible idea. I think you can't do that. You have to just show people enjoying it, and you have to make it seem approachable and inviting. And that's what the Wii did really, really well. I mean, they had long conversations that Nintendo said over and over and over again. We wanted it to make look like something that was already in their home, a TV remote. You've got to see, they need some way to show people playing it in a way that seems, you know, seems inviting and seems approachable.
Well, maybe they're going to wait until after the holidays, because the thing is going to sell out for the holidays anyway.
Yeah. Oh, yeah,
and
definitely.
They had the situation the first when the Wii came out, where they had bought tons of TV time for their ads, and then they had to scramble and replace the time that they had bought for Wii ads and replace them with DS ads, because they realized, oh crap, like we're hyping this up and we don't have any stock left to sell.
That's a good problem to have, yeah.
Sure, so, it is, but I mean, like, perhaps they're going to be more, not spend so much on TV ads before the holidays. And then, you know, the coast is clear. There's less ads, I suppose, on TV for gadgets. And then they can try to sell that to everyone who hasn't bought one yet.
So wait, you're saying all those Elite Beat Agents ads I saw were actually supposed to be Wii ads, but they switched them up at the last minute? I saw them at least twice a week for about 4 months straight.
Really?
Christmas. Yeah.
I do remember reading about how they switched from Wii ads to DS ads. Yeah.
But couldn't you also make the argument that the fact that the Wii was hard to get made it more desirable? I mean, when I first started on this show, the Wii was still impossible. God, I've been here a long time. The Wii was still hard to get. I mean, it was a legitimately difficult item to go to a store and purchase.
Yeah.
And it felt like that actually increased demand for it amongst a segment of the population.
Yeah. When you started on the show, I had to send my roommate at the time to Maine, to another country, to get a Wii.
Maine is another country, even if you're an American.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that inability to get the game is desirable. I also wonder if they missed a huge free marketing opportunity by the game coming out the 5 days before Black Friday.
Yeah.
So the Wii itself sold in large part because of word of mouth. Do you think they screwed up by not having this game in the system in home on Thanksgiving? And they could see, like, when they visit family, they bring it along, and then...
Right, but I think that the word of mouth, just the fact that it's called the Wii U, might still work. I mean, I don't know really how it was initially when the Wii came out, but was there some convincing to be made? Like when you were doing a Wii party, let's say, like, did you have to explain to people, oh, like you move around, like this is how you control the games?
So I actually got a Wii on launch day, and I brought it to American Thanksgiving, by the way, which is the day before Black Friday, which is what the Black Friday is defined by.
For me, and Thanksgiving is just a day off work.
it's a day off work and a day that I'm obligated, unfortunately, to spend time with family members. So in the end, it's like work, but with more fighting. But we set the Wii up. No, I set it up in the garage, which, you know, doesn't sound as bad as it is. I mean, it's a nice garage.
It's a car holder.
You know, people, you know, I, my cousin, who's roughly my age, he knew about it. He had never played one. You know, he came out and played it. Some other people, as they were just sort of passing through, you know, saw it being played, and that was generally enough to get them to play it once or twice.
Right.
And I didn't have to sit there and be like, you should play this, honest, it's great. Like, it seemed accessible enough to them on first blush that they didn't really need convincing.
Right, but they needed to see it. My thinking is that perhaps it's going to be easier this time to, you know, just call up people and say, like, do you want to play the successor to the Wii? Like, just come over. We're going to have, you know, we're going to play some video games. I don't know. I think that there might be some interest there. Like, sure, there's a big segment of Wii owners who get tired of their Wii, but that doesn't mean that they might not still be interested in seeing what else, you know, Nintendo came up with.
I wonder if the name is confusing to me now, because I've been in GameStops where people see signage for Wii U, which is out there. It's been out there for about a month now.
Mm-hmm.
And people ask, you know, what is it? Is it just a tablet? And then the clerk starts to explain, no, it's a new game system. It's the replacement for the Wii. And I don't think I've seen anybody come in who didn't know what it was and immediately get that it's not a peripheral.
Yeah, like I think the point is that they do ask about it. You know, they're interested. So that's a form of word of mouth.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I didn't think about it that way. Yeah. I mean, the there is inevitably going to be some confusion because the names obviously are effectively the same.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, if the Wii branding hadn't been there, would they have asked about it? Probably not. What I am wondering is, you know, how do they differentiate this as a new system? I mean, the Wii's still going to be on the market. It just had a price drop. I mean, we saw this with the DS. They called the 3DS part of the, quote, DS family of systems, which is about as dry a statement as the one as I just presented it. I mean, do you think they obviously didn't feel like the 3DS name hurt them, or that it was just too late to do anything about it. Do you think they're going to try to market that as part of the Wii family of systems? Or do you think they'll keep a very clean line between Wii marketing and Wii U marketing?
Oh, no. Haven't they already shown that their tagline or whatever it is for the Wii U is, "What will you play next?"
Oh, God.
Yeah. God. I think they've learned their lesson from the DS to 3DS transition. At this point, they have put a bullet in the Wii. The only thing left they have to do is drop it to $99 and then discontinue it. So,
well, I mean, they just dropped it to $129. So, yeah, I mean,
they've got one.
They put a bullet in the GBA. It didn't matter.
Yeah. Basically, I think they might have to pull a Microsoft here with what Microsoft did with the original Xbox. They need to cut off the Wii next year. Like, don't even let Just Dance come out for it. Make it Wii U.
I don't think they'll ever do that.
No, because, I mean, they still make money off of it. I mean, the license fees alone are probably great for them. I mean, yeah, but I do recall Microsoft was more than happy to end last generation because I don't think they felt like they were where they should have been. I think
But also Microsoft was in a special situation because they were kind of in a fight with NVIDIA because I think... Okay, this is purely what I remember, and I think my info is from message boards, so it might be completely inaccurate. But I think that their deal with NVIDIA made it so that they couldn't really drop the price of the graphics card, you know, like pay less over time. So
don't suck.
Yeah. So they just, you know, once they realized that that was going on, they weren't really in good terms with NVIDIA, and I think they probably took a loss on the Xbox for longer than they would have wanted to. And so they were more than happy to just say, like, you know what, we're starting over, screw NVIDIA, we're going with ATI probably.
ATI. Yeah.
Yeah. And clean slate.
Yeah. Which is also Nintendo's video card producer of choice since the GameCube and will continue to be. Yeah, one more thing I want to discuss, how you sell it, and this one's a little bit more difficult to put my head around, is what are they going to do about Miiverse? Now, to me, it seems like it's a social – I mean, it's obviously a bit of a social networking thing, and it's an attempt to sort of keep word of mouth going on individual games. You could see your friends are talking about this game a lot, and you're like, well, maybe I want to get it. But – it also seems like it's a kind of feature that you could use to sell the system as more of a communication device. If they've got some kind of idea around how they're going to sell that, I mean, again, this is just another set of features in this box, this in a very non-Nintendo sort of way. I mean, for God's sakes, the Wii didn't even have a proper microphone. This is video conferencing. What? I mean, are they even going to attempt to sell that? I mean, they put it in there. They must intend to sell it.
Well, I could easily imagine an Animal Crossing type of ad. You know, the one where they had these two women just sitting down talking, you know, about stuff. Whatever women talk about. And,
whatever these women talk about, I don't know.
And and Guillaume's the one with the girlfriend, by the way.
But yeah, then it turns out that they're playing Animal Crossing and they're talking through We Speak. So I think that they might have kind of a twist like that in an ad. I don't know. It could be cool. I mean, the Miiverse has a lot of potential, and
it does.
Certainly, like seeing your friends me playing Call of Duty, you know, it's cute and it's useful. You know, okay, so he's playing Call of Duty. Maybe I should fire it up. It's a good feature, and it might be a little bit hard. Like if you try to explain it to people, you're gonna have a hell of a time.
I know.
They can try to show it though. You know, like just show a slice of life moment.
I mean, you're probably right. That's probably the best they can do. I mean, I look at the Wii U and say, God, they gave themselves like a on the 10 on the difficulty scale of putting features in this thing that are hard to show. Hard to explain in words quickly. I mean, I'm curious. All right, what games do you think they're going to use to sell the Wii on the first shot? Nintendo Land, obviously. But do you think any others are going to get really featured prominently? I mean,
well, it's so strange because the Nintendo Store in New York has received Wii U's. They're on display, mm-hmm. and they're playing Rayman.
Game that won't even be out till 2013.
Yeah, but that's the game they chose. I think that next week they're receiving Nintendo Land. And they're going to be displaying that, but for right now, Rayman. And I don't know, maybe it's a good choice. It does show the asymmetrical multiplayer, and it's a gorgeous game. And it's a game that most people who will pick up the controller over there are going to know instantly how to play. Because it looks like Mario, it plays like Mario.
Yeah,
I do wonder, though, why not Mario U? I mean, I know it's not as great asymmetric gameplay, but you're at the Nintendo Store, for God's sake.
Yeah.
It's weird. I'm very interested in when the Best Buys around here get the Wii U setups, what they're going to have on them.
I kind of wonder if Nintendo itself doesn't know that Mario Wii U looks incredibly a lot like the previous Mario games that they've made, so they're kind of shying away from relying too much on it to sell the console.
I wouldn't be surprised, because right now the XLs at stores have New Super Mario Bros. 2 on them.
Yeah, I think for North America, U.S. and Canada, basically, it'll be probably Rayman and Nintendo Land. Europe will probably get Mario and FIFA. And Japan, Monster Hunter, done.
Yeah, that's they don't even need to put up demo. It's like, this system has Monster Hunter. You may go to your store and buy it now. Yeah, for us, it seems like it's a much more interesting proposition, but I think you might be right. I think FIFA and Mario probably work out well in Europe.
Yeah.
And
although I think the extra bundle in Europe has Zombie U in it, but I guess that'll play well for, especially where we're in Ubisoft country there.
Yeah. I'm just not sure they can put that out on demo units.
Yeah.
Because
kids.
Graphic content. The more I think about it, the more Rayman seems to make sense because, sure, like a lot of gamers know about Rayman Origins, but I think that most of the general population would think, like, ooh, a brand new game, a franchise that I'm not really aware of. Didn't I see that guy in the first Rabbids game?
Oh, God. All right. Any final thoughts on how to market the various functionalities of Wii? Even I'm doing it. Wii U. There.
They could very much take a Microsoft tactic with it, just, you know, let it with games, and then you can build up the multimedia features over time.
But the multimedia features are already there. I mean, Microsoft added them post-launch. I mean, the Xbox Now is not the same system as the Xbox when it came out.
Right. I think that we've already seen Nintendo's plan with this. I think that they've started doing public demonstrations much sooner than they did with the Wii. They're trying to get the Wii U in people's hands a lot more actively than they did the Wii. And I think they're going to keep doing that. And actually, speaking of taking a page from Microsoft's book, perhaps, you know, they could rent a space in malls somewhere and, you know, just during the holidays and have that space to let people try the Wii U. That could be successful for them.
I could see that.
Except Microsoft took all the prime spaces already for Windows 8.
There you go. My final thought on it is, we haven't touched on this particular piece of functionality yet, but I'm really curious how Nintendo is going to push digital versions of retail games. Because for them, every piece of the puzzle works out best for them if people buy digital copies. They don't have to deal with shipping. They don't have to deal with manufacturing. Because remember, Nintendo does that for the publisher. They don't have to deal with pretty much anything. I mean, and I'm sure they get a bigger profit cut, and the publishers are happier, and that makes the Wii U a more attractive platform for people to develop for. I mean, for Nintendo, every time a digital copy is sold versus a retail copy is a cause for celebration. I mean, today we saw a bunch of Nintendo 3DS games come out on the download service.
Right.
How do you drive people, because I know the Wii had a lot of struggles with this, how do you drive people to the Wii U shop? And how do you make sure people get their Wii U's online? How do you make sure people know that they can get these retail games on the system? And how do you convince people to pay the same price for download games? I mean, they've already committed that their games, at least, are going to be the same price.
Well, yeah, except for the whole 10% rebate in points, or not rebate, but
if
like 10% back.
If you got Black Wii U.
Yeah. I don't know how they can try to leverage that. All I know is that they still have a ways to go, because at least in Canada, because I tried, I registered to Best Buy's reward zone specifically because I wanted to take advantage of as many points, rewards, systems as I could simultaneously. I wanted to get specifically Nintendo cards through Best Buy so I could get, you know, both the certificates from Reward Zone and the kind of discount that Nintendo is going to offer. But then it turns out that you can't really order Nintendo eShop cards from the Canadian Best Buy website. And then I went and checked on Amazon.ca, and you can't get the cards there either. On the US shop, you can. So I don't know if it's some sort of weird law where you can't really buy cash cards online, or who knows? I guess that, like, maybe it's Nintendo's fault here, and that they haven't really been proactive enough in trying to get retailers to sell their cards. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm like Johnny. I've lost my 3DS before and lost content because of it. So Nintendo's got, I'm not sure what Nintendo can do to get me to go digital on the Wii U, but it's probably not going to work. Just because I've been down that road before, and until they get an account system, I'm not even going to consider it.
And I think targeting the average consumer who probably has never bought a console game digitally. I mean, I've only done it once. It's going to be an interesting sell. All right, I think that'll do it for us. I think those were interesting enough topics. As always, remember, send us your email, questions, comments, whatever you got. RFN@NintendoWorldReport.com. Again, there's also a handy form on the site that I'm sure will be in the show notes. I want to go ahead and thank Donald for being on the show and filling in for us this week. Why don't you give him a real quick rundown about the podcast again?
Okay, it's Nintendo Free Radio. It's myself, Stephen Shook, and Austin Parkin are the hosts, and we've shamelessly ripped off the RFN format, which is...
So did we. We ripped it off from people, so you're fine.
Okay. And we come out every couple of weeks, editing troubles aside. We have a new episode that's going to be out by the time you hear this, and we'll actually be taping a new one on the release day of this podcast. Yeah, so we're bi-weekly, and there's you can go to nintendofreeradio.podbean.com, find all the...
I'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah, that'll go in the show notes as well. Or you can go to, or we have a thread on the forums, usually in the general chat forum, every time a new episode comes up.
Again, and also always thank you to Guillaume for both editing and being here.
Oh, I'm not editing this week. No one told you.
Oh, really?
You're handling that. No, I'm kidding.
Oh. I was about to say, so this episode will never be heard by anyone.
Okay.
And although he's already left, thanks to Nate for, again, filling in for the absentee father that is John Lindemann. Also wanted to go ahead and remind you the third annual NWR Live Podcast Telethon for Child's Play is doing it again this year. The date is Saturday, November 10th. We'll be starting at noon Eastern, and we'll be going until we run out of money. So remember, this is just like the last few years. We're going to do a segment by segment, hour by hour, based on money targets that we reach. There'll be lots of content from the RFN staff, from the site staff, and in fact, saying it right here, there's actually going to be a segment from the Nintendo Free Radio crew.
Yep. I won't give away too much. I will say, in preparation for our segment, I visited the man from Nantucket. His reputation is highly overblown.
Oh, good lord. Okay. As always, content on NintendoWorldReport.com. They also have Connectivity, episode 55. This one has more Denpa men, so feel free to go and enjoy that. And there'll probably be another episode coming out soon around the time of this episode. There's also a Radio Free Nintendo Facebook page which you can go visit. Johnny curates it, so I'm sorry. Rate and review us on iTunes. I don't mention that one enough. Be sure to do it. Oh, yes, and Twitter profiles. Let's go run down what our Twitter accounts are. I have one. It's NWR_James. Donald, do you have a Twitter account that you may mention? I know the answer to this, but go ahead and say it.
Yes, I am at Donald Mick. That's M-I-C-K on the second half.
And Guillaume?
Pandarius, N-W-R.
You might want to spell it.
Panda, R-E-U-S, N-W-R.
Awesome. So two U's and an R. Got it. So I think that'll do it for us tonight. Once again, thanks guys for being here, and absentee thanks to Nate. Be here next week. Good night.
Good night.
Bye.
Yeah,
maybe show a commercial where this family is playing the Mario game on a TV, and then I don't know, they all leave. And so, oh, okay, no, this is a terrible commercial. Let's say one person is playing Mario on the TV, and then the family comes in and they can watch TV while he's playing Mario on the tablet, on the gamepad.
Yombe advertising director.